one of the reasons why this system has been sustained is that we've completely isolated everybody who's incarcerated by the distance at which prisons are put, by how difficult it is even to make phone calls. It's $5 a minute to make a phone call in many, many states because of the contracts that telecom companies have to make money off of people who are incarcerated who already have so little. The educational programs that have been gutted, these are all forms of isolating so that you don't know what's going on, so that those people remain kind of the other, you remain scared of them. They're not people. And those are all of the things that are necessary to then kind of generate a punitiveness that we see at the polls.
That's James Forman Jr., and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features James Forman Jr. on crime and punishment in Black America. Critics of the U.S. criminal justice system, such as Michelle Alexander and Brian Stevenson, have assailed the rise of mass incarceration with its disproportionate impact on people of color. The war on crime that began in the 1970s was supported by many African-American leaders in the nation's urban centers. The first substantial cohort of Black mayors, judges, and police chiefs took office amid a surge in crime and drug addiction. Many prominent Black officials feared that the gains of the civil rights movement were being undermined by lawlessness. They thus embraced tough-on-crime measures, including mandatory sentencing and aggressive police tactics, and what Angela Davis called the prison industrial complex. In the face of skyrocketing murder rates and the proliferation of open-air drug markets, African-American officials and community leaders believed they had no choice, but the policies they adopted would have devastating consequences for residents of poor Black neighborhoods. To talk about these issues is James Forman Jr. He's a professor of law at Yale Law School. He's written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, and numerous other publications. A former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, he spent 6 years as a public defender in Washington, D.C., where he co-founded the Maya Angelou Public Charter School. He's the author of Locking Up Our Own. He spoke at Chicago Kent College of Law. And now, James Forman Jr.
I thought I would start by talking about my motivations for the project. When I was a student and I would listen to professors or academics or public speakers come and talk about their projects, a question that I always had in my mind is kind of what brought them to that project. And so for me, one of my motivations, I had really two big motivations. One of them had nothing to do with the criminal system whatsoever. And it has to do with the fact that I was the kind of person who, when I went to a movie or when I see a television show, and if there's no African-American characters in the show, or if they're portrayed in a really kind of one-dimensional light, I'm always very frustrated by that. And so I knew, and I feel that way about film, but I also feel that way about history, I feel that way about sociology, I feel that way about law. So I knew that my project, I wanted to have African-American characters, academics, intellectuals, politicians, civic leaders, on every page, in leadership positions, and also I wanted to convey the complexity and the multidimensionality and the disagreements and the fissures within that community. So the other motivation for me really did come out of my experience in the criminal system. One of the stories that I tell is of a young man I represented by the name of Brandon. And Brandon was my client, juvenile client, in Superior Court, Washington, D.C. in the mid-1990s. And he had been arrested for and charged with and had pled guilty to possession of a gun and possession of a small amount of marijuana, $15, $20 worth. And he was facing sentencing. And I was his lawyer. And I had taken the job of being a public defender because I viewed it as the civil rights issue of my generation. My parents met in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. My dad's African-American, my mom is white. They're an interracial couple at a time when those marriages were illegal in many states in this country. And their generation's struggle, right, changed America profoundly, made it possible for somebody like me to have life opportunities that were unimaginable to a black man of my father's generation growing up in de jure and de facto segregated Mississippi and de jure and de facto segregated Chicago. But at the same time as I was having those opportunities, and some in my generation were, it was also clear that there was a lot of unfinished business to the civil rights movement. And the place where it seemed like that unfinished business was manifesting itself most consistently and significantly, profoundly, was in the criminal legal system. We didn't have the term mass incarceration when I became a public defender. That was a term created in the year 2000. But we already knew, even then, we already knew some of the numbers that have become familiar, increasingly familiar today. We already knew that 1 in 3 young African-American men was under criminal justice supervision. The United States had passed Russia and South Africa to become the world's largest jailer. That had happened in the late 1980s. By the mid-1990s, it was already the case that the United States had 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. And I had seen this playing out even over the course of my own life. I grew up in Atlanta, and where I grew up, a couple blocks away from my home, were two huge buildings, mammoth institutions. One was the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, and the other was a General Motors plant. By the time I graduated from law school, 15, 20 years later, one of those buildings had closed down, and the other had built an addition. And so I saw that reality and the impact that it was having even in my community, even as some of us were having opportunities like the ones that I had. And so I decided to become a public defender to fight on the front lines. And that brought me to Superior Court, Washington, D.C., to be standing next to Brandon. I was asking for him to be put on probation. It was his first arrest. I had a letter from a teacher and a counselor at his school attesting to his character. His mother and grandmother were there in court sitting in the front row. They wanted him to come home. The prosecutor in the case was asking for him to be locked up. She wanted him to go to Oak Hill. Oak Hill is the name of D.C.'s juvenile prison, and like so many juvenile prisons around this country, and as y'all are familiar with if you know anything about the juvenile facilities around here, it was a place that really deserved youth. Oak Hill was a place where drugs and violence were rampant. It was a place where you always left worse off than when you went in as a kid. The judge that had to make the decision in the case and decide what to do, Judge Curtis Walker, and I changed his name. I changed the names of all the judges and the lawyers, and that was to protect the identity of my clients. Changed my clients' names too, of course. Judge Walker looks out in the courtroom and he sees a young black man facing sentencing. That's not unusual. D.C., you go to Superior Court, look who's charged with crime. You would think there were no white people who lived in D.C. African-American defense attorney, African-American prosecutor, the judge himself was African-American. That's not unusual in D.C. 40% of the Superior Court judges are black. So Judge Walker looks out at Brandon and he says, "Son, Mr. Foreman's been telling me that you've had a tough life. You deserve a second chance. Well, son, let me tell you about tough. Let me tell you about Jim Crow segregation." Judge told Brandon what it was like to grow up in those times because the judge had known those times. And then in wrapping up, the judge said, "So here's the thing, son. People fought, people marched, people died for your freedom. Dr. King died for you. And I'll tell you this, he didn't die for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family and embarrassing your community." No, that was not his dream at all. "So I hope Mr. Foreman is right. I hope you do turn it around one day. But this day in this courtroom, actions have consequences, and your consequence is Oak Hill." And he locked him up. I was so angry. I mean, the judge had taken the same history that I just cited to you as my motivation to become a public defender. And he had somehow flipped it on its head and was using it as a justification for incarcerating my client. And as I began to kind of work through some of that, as you can see, it's an ongoing process, working through that anger. But as I began to work through it, I began to think about the fact that, you know, the judge wasn't alone. I told you 40% of the judges in D.C. were African American, but it's also true that the police force in the city is majority black. The police chief was black. The mayor was black. The city council that passed the gun and the drug laws that Brandon was sentenced under was majority African American. The chief prosecutor of the city was Eric Holder. At that moment, I felt like somebody had to try to kind of answer this question and tell this story that my colleagues and I in the Public Defender Service would talk about all the time, but nobody had really answered, right? And by the way, as in, you know, for those students that are thinking about going into, you know, academia, you have the beginnings of a project. You might have a project when you see something out in the world that you cannot figure out, and then when you go reading, it doesn't seem like anybody's actually, you know, told that story, explained that. And so for me, it was telling that story of our criminal system over the last 50 years, but through the lens of African-American prosecutors, police chiefs, judges, legislators, citizen activists, everyday citizens, trying to figure out through their voices what was going on and how was it that at least some of them had come to think that some of these policies that the United States as a nation was pursuing made sense. What was going on? Were they tricked? Were they coerced? What was the story? Well, the first thing I think that we have to grapple with to understand this is rising crime and violence throughout this country, but especially in African American communities, and the fear and the anger that it generated. So, in the 1960s, right before the first generation of African-American officials would come into power and come take office in any number in this country, the homicide rate in the country doubled. In some cities like D.C., it tripled. In Chicago, it more than doubled. And at the same time, right, as bodies were falling at a rate that nobody had seen before, a drug was sweeping through cities, through black communities especially. And it wasn't crack, which would come in the 80s and early 90s. It was heroin, which was the crack in black communities before there was crack. In the night, they test everyone entering the D.C. jail for drugs. And in 1964, they found that 1963, they found that 4% of the people were addicts, heroin addicts. By 1969, the 4% had become 45%. Now, that's an epidemic. And it wasn't just the numbers, but it was also the anger that it generated. One of the things that I did is I benefited from the fact that a lot of elected officials gave over their papers to local archives. And they gave over not just their, when they retired from office, and not just their official statements, but also what they received in the form of letters from citizens. So there's this whole kind of social history, treasure trove. It's not scanned. It's no keyword searching. It's just pieces of paper and files. But if you go through them for many summers, you will see this incredible story. Right? This is a 70% African American city in the 1970s. D.C. was Chocolate City. So these are mostly black citizens writing to mostly black elected officials. 11 out of the first 13 city council members in D.C. were African American. And the letters reveal this anguish. People are saying, listen, we just won the civil rights movement, and yet there's all this violence and destruction. I feel like a prisoner in my own home. I feel like a stranger in my own streets. I can't take my kids to school because they're selling drugs on the corner. I don't want them to see that. I can't leave them in the park after school because they're shooting in the park. And over again, people are saying, please do something. Do something about this. Now, who's receiving these letters? There's a generation of people that are receiving these letters. Are this first generation of African-American officials to get elected in any significant number since Reconstruction? So in the 1970s and early 1980s, there's an 800% increase nationally in African-American elected officials as compared to basically before the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is a generation of people. Many of them are from the South. Some of them were in the Civil Rights Movement. All of them remember the long history of under-enforcement and under-protection of the law in black communities. My father used to tell me about this, talking about Mississippi mainly, but also Chicago, too, in the 40s. He said, we didn't call the police when there was a crime in a black neighborhood. The police weren't going to come. They didn't care. And if they came, the only thing you could know for sure is they were going to make matters worse. They remember, this generation remembers decades, centuries, Southern sheriffs, and not just, I should say, sheriffs with a Southern mentality, because not all of them were in the South. In cahoots with the Klan, they asked about black homicide in a black neighborhood. They said, that's not a homicide, that's another dead black person. And they didn't use the words black person. So they're a generation that is formed and shaped by this history. And now they have some semblance of local control, some influence on local government. And they're bound and determined to make the things they can control, which is mainly the local police departments. They're determined, whenever they can, is to make them respond to communities that never got that protection for centuries. Okay, so there's a reason, right? There's a crisis, crime, and then there's a motivation to respond to it, a racial justice motivation in some instances. But why is it police and prisons and prosecutors? Why is that the response? The choices that black officials made is also and has to be about the constraints and the limitations on their ability to choose, right? The limited options that they had available to them. So let me talk about what some of those constraints were. The first constraint is historical. Right? Black elected officials overwhelmingly have been elected to represent neighborhoods, whether they're in the North or whether they're in the South, neighborhoods that, because of slavery and Jim Crow and structural and institutional racism, because of redlining, because of decisions about where to put highways, right, including in my own town of Atlanta, 1950s, got to build the federal highways. Where's it going to go? Auburn Avenue was called the Black Wall Street back in the 40s. I-75, I-85, if you've ever driven through Atlanta, you have driven right through the middle of what had been a thriving black community destroyed by the highway. Right? So because of a history of government choices, these are neighborhoods that have been deprived of the resources to protect themselves and so therefore are over-reliant on law enforcement as a form of protection. The second constraint is a political one. It's about city council members. It's about mayors. It's about local police chiefs and police officers. And one of my arguments is that the local matters more than we've given it credit for in understanding how mass incarceration came to be and also how we can dismantle it, right? And African-American political power is concentrated locally. That's why my story is a local. It's concentrated in city councils, county councils, mayor's offices. And local matters, but there are limits to what local government can do. For 50 years, black elected officials at the local level and the few that have been in Congress have had what I call an all of the above strategy to fighting crime and violence. They've said we want more police and more prosecutors, and sometimes even said we want more prisons. But they've also said, we want more money for schools and more money for housing and more money for jobs and drug treatment and mental health treatment. We want national gun control. We're passing local gun control laws wherever we can, Chicago, New York, Detroit, D.C., trying in Atlanta. But we know local gun control isn't going to solve the problem. We know that we need national gun control. They're going to Congress and they're saying, we want a Marshall Plan for urban America. After World War II, the United States government invested in rebuilding Europe. We want the same thing to happen, the same investments in our African-American communities in our cities. So for 50 years, black representatives go to Congress, go to the White House with this all-of-the-above strategy. And for 50 years, they come back with money for one of the above, law enforcement. One more constraint that I want to mention. And it's a constraint that I think we still suffer from to this day. And this is a generations really, that was constrained by their imaginations in terms of how to respond to a profound social problem. So let me give you an example of what I mean by that. One of the people that I write about is a guy named David Clark. Now, David Clark, I told you that 11 out of 13 of the first city council in D.C. was African American. David Clark is one of the two white members. He has a very unusual biography. He went to Howard Law School, was only white student in his class. Graduated, worked late 1960s for Martin Luther King in D.C. Then he becomes a lawyer for poor people. Then in the mid-1970s, home rule, a form of home rule comes to D.C. He runs for city council. And he's elected. Now, Dave Clark, the thing you need to know about him for the purposes of this story is he is not a drug warrior. The first thing that he does, the first piece of legislation that he pushes for in 1975, 2 days into the beginning of the first Home Rule City Council, is marijuana decriminalization. It doesn't pass. A few years later, he's chair of the city council. And heroin, which had kind of stepped back in the 70s, has now come back in force in the early 1980s, and those letters that I told you about are ramping up again in number and volume and in tone, and people are saying things like, and I don't endorse this language, but you know, there's a junkie nodding off on my stoop and they're gathering behind my house and they're sharing needles and they're leaving needles in the alleys and they're congregating everywhere. And again, do something, you gotta do something about it. So David Clark gets these citizen letters and he forwards them to the head of the relevant government agency. And he then gets a letter back. Councilmember Clark, we received your complaint from the city that you forwarded, from the citizen at such and such address. We're on the case. And Clark then takes those letters and sends them back to the citizen who originally wrote. So that's like pretty good constituent service. I never get, like, barely get my emails responded to, an auto reply. So this is good. But who does this non-drug warrior, marijuana decriminalizer, send? Remember, the problem is there's an addict in public space, a user. So who does he send the letter to? The head of the Department of Addiction Services, Department of Mental Health, Drug Treatment? No. Because he's not a drug warrior, but he's an American. And like so many of us in this country, he's come to adopt a mindset and been raised to have a mindset where his imagination is so constrained that he can only think of this as a police problem. So he sends it to the police chief. Because we have come to think of the problem of an addict in public space as a law enforcement problem, not a public health problem, not a social, not a mental health problem, not an addiction and treatment problem. Let me spend a few minutes talking now about the question, the companion question to all of this, which is, okay, so here we are, 2018, right? What do we do about this? What do we do about the fact that we live in a country that has 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners? Like, just, right, something is wrong with that. That can't be a normal and good state of affairs. Like, you don't find anybody is like, yes, that's what I want. Now, you find lots of people who do things that produce that outcome. Maybe some of them do want it, but not a lot of people come out and say that that's what they want. So the first thing I want to say about this as kind of a way of thinking about responding goes to that point that I ended with about imagination. Because I do think one of the biggest starting challenges that we face is cultivating our imaginations both collectively and individually to the point where we can both imagine a world, right? A world that seems like, that seems, you know, quite literally unimaginable now, right? A world without without prisons, or if that's too far for you, a world with a dramatically reduced prison and jail footprint. 25%, 30%, you know, you pick your number of what percent of what we have now do we want to achieve. And it's a particularly, and then what are the sorts of things, the investments that we need to make in society, the changes in our justice system to achieve that? And it's a particularly different challenge, I want to say, this idea of cultivating your imagination that I want to raise with lawyers and with law students, especially with the law students. Because law school is great for many things. But one of the weaknesses of law school is that we're not especially good at teaching people how to cultivate their imaginations, to think about a world that's beyond the world that we have right now, right? It's the legal, we talk about teaching you to think like a lawyer. So you go into law, like you come with all these dreams and visions, and then you get here, and what we do is we basically like beat you down to the point where, because what we're trying to train you to do is, okay, well, you get these facts and this precedent. What is the likely outcome? What is the judge likely to do? Right? But the problem is, and that's all predicated, right? The whole model is predicated on the idea that that we have something to be proud of precedentially, right? It starts with the idea that we have this amazing constitution. But here's the thing. In our criminal system, there's no precedent to be proud of. It's broken and defective. The system, and that includes the laws, the legal precedents, the policies and institutions, the system that collectively produced a number like 5% and 25%, something's wrong with the system. So the very kind of status quo precedent orientation of law school works against our ability to do the thing that we actually need to do, which is, you know, basically the starting proposition is, if you're talking about something in the criminal system, the starting proposition is that whatever we've been doing, do the opposite of that. But we don't do a good job of teaching you that in law school. So we, that means then as professors, it's our obligation to try to teach in a different way. And as students, it means that whether you're getting that or not, you kind of got to push yourself with your reading outside of class and elsewhere to push yourself to that kind of thinking. But let's get a little bit more concrete. For those of you, especially that if you're not in a position of policy making or decision making right now, right? But you have many of you have your legal careers ahead of you. And in that regard, I would say, you know, my own work as a public defender, I continue to believe that that work is incredibly impactful, incredibly powerful. Going into that work, I really encourage, but there's also the other side, prosecution. And what I want to say about that is it's not just a question of career choices, but it's also as citizens. You know, until a couple of years ago, and really in some ways still to this day, a lot of people don't know both the power that the local prosecutor has, and they don't know that as citizens, that person is accountable to us as voters. The local prosecutor and the local sheriff overwhelmingly is an elected official. And like nobody votes in these elections. So it doesn't need to be that many of us that come together to change the course of who's our locally elected prosecutor or sheriff. And we saw that in the last election, November of 2016. The good news from that election, and that's not a phrase that like rolls off of my tongue, but the good news from that election is that for the first time in my lifetime around this country, a whole slate of people ran for prosecutor on an agenda of my predecessors locked up too many people, there's too many wrongful convictions, the bail system is broken, I'm opposed to the death penalty, nonviolent drug offenses shouldn't be prosecuted at all, or if they should, it should be a civil infraction. Like, these are phrases that for 45 years you never could utter those phrases and be elected a local prosecutor. And then it happened. I mean, you have your own story here in Chicago. We also have Denver. We have in Florida, in Georgia, and Alabama, in Texas, a career defense attorney with the words not guilty tattooed on his chest ran for local prosecutor in Texas and won on a reform agenda. And that's because citizens are starting to wake up and they're starting to mobilize. And so I would encourage everybody in this room, if you don't know wherever you go live, where you settle after you graduate from here, if you're a student or if you're living here, know who your local prosecutor is, know who your local sheriff is, get engaged in those races, go to those citizen forums, ask them questions, because my prediction is that in the next 5 years, we're going to see what we just had in November of 2016 is going to be like, the tip of the iceberg for the kind of reform that we're going to see created by citizens demanding a new form of prosecution.
You're listening to James Forman Jr. on Crime and Punishment in Black America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
But that's still a little bit far out. What about right now? What about something that's more immediate, something that's more direct? And there I want to put to everybody that if you do nothing else, think about going into and getting involved with program, whether it's a tutoring program or a mentoring program or a restorative justice program or an apprenticeship or a job training program, something in the local prison, local jail, local corrections facility where you live. One of the reasons why this system has been sustained is that we've completely isolated everybody who's incarcerated. Right? The goal of the system has been to isolate them as thoroughly as possible by the distance at which prisons are put, by how difficult it is even to make phone calls, how expensive it is. Skype is free. I was talking to an academic in Vietnam the other day for free, and it's $5 a minute to make a phone call in many, many states because of the contracts that telecom companies have to make money off of people who are incarcerated, who already have so little. The educational programs that have been gutted, these are all forms of isolating, right? One part of society, so that you don't know what's going on, so that those people remain kind of the other, you remain scared of them. They're not people, they're just charges. And those are all of the things that are necessary to then kind of generate a punitiveness that we see at the polls. Well, the only way to undo that, the only way to remove the isolation and the separation is to get close, is to get proximate. There's lots of ways. Virtually every jail and prison in the country has various forms of educational programs that you can get involved with as a volunteer. And I thought about this a lot myself a couple years ago. I thought I'd teach a class on race and justice at Yale Law School. And I love it. It's a great class. But I was talking about, well, what other people can do and getting close. And I thought about my own teaching. And I would put this out there to anybody who's a teacher. I got trained in a program called Inside Out, which trains professors to teach the class that you normally teach in your university, to teach it in a prison. And to have the student body of the class is half people who are incarcerated and half people from your home university. So I teach a class on issues in criminal justice, but it doesn't have to be criminal justice. A lot of the inside-out classes on philosophy, on English, on art, on math, on any subject matter, whatever your field is. And it's the best and most impactful teaching I've ever done. I always tell my colleagues, don't do it for self-interested reasons, but it is true that the best teaching evaluations that I get are in my inside-out class. And the most meaningful ones are from the incarcerated students. One of them wrote at the end of the last class I taught, he wrote, I like the law and the policy that we learned in this class, but most of all what I liked was that when I entered the seminar room, entered the circle, I was treated like I was smart, and I was treated like I had something to say. And on some days, I even felt like I was an intellectual. And I don't want to minimize the structural differences between the life circumstance of somebody who ends up at law school and someone that ends up incarcerated. They're huge. But one thing is, were you treated in school? Because he told me that it was his first time he felt like that way in a classroom. And that was really the tragedy of it. Were you treated as somebody who had something to offer, or were you treated as the problem, as he was? Another young man wrote at the end of the semester, he said, my favorite thing about this class was that for 2 hours a week, I could kind of, sort of, forget that I was in prison. Now, I don't know how that experience of that class is going to carry forward with them and change their lives, but I know how it changed mine and how it changed the students that I taught from my home university. So whatever the project is, for you it might be inside out, it might be something else, but break down those barriers of isolation and separation that sustain the fear and the stigma in this country. You know, I've thrown out a few different ideas, but these are like two or three of probably the thousands of things that any of us could do. And sometimes people come up to me and say, you know, what do you think is like the most impactful thing? You know, what's the most important thing that I can do? And I always feel like, you know, really the answer to that, it depends on you and it depends on what you care about. It depends on what you love. This is a system that was built up over 50 years of tiny, small steps, some of them known and predictable, many of them unknown and unpredictable, right? That together accumulated to be the bricks that then built this prison nation. And the only way we're going to unbuild it, the only way we're going to return to any kind of sanity, any kind of real justice, is small piece, small brick, one brick at a time. So really, I think the question I think what we all have to recognize is that none of us will be able to solve this by ourselves, but collectively we will. And that's going to require each of us to find that thing that we're good at. You know, I'm a teacher, so the thing that I'm doing is teaching, right? But your thing will be maybe something else. It may be a form of lawyering. It may be business development for formerly incarcerated folks, returning citizens. It may be working on restoring the right to vote, ending felon disenfranchisement. The last thing that I'm going to say is not a particular idea, but it's just a way of thinking about the problem that we face. And it comes from a conversation that I had with my dad. It was a few years before he passed away, and we had watched a movie about the civil rights movement. And I asked him what he thought about it. You know, he was there. What did he think? And he said, well, he liked it because they showed the history on screen. And he said, you know, more people watch movies than read books. He said, you know, I liked it, but the thing that I didn't like about it was that they made it seem like everybody was involved in the movement. And he said it was not like that. We were the minority, right? We were unpopular. A majority of people was asked a month or two before the March on Washington that we all celebrate now, do you think the March on Washington is going to help or hurt Black people? They said the cause of the Negro. Well, 60% of Americans said it was going to hurt. Dr. King was Gallup poll 1966, popular, unpopular, favorable, unfavorable. His unfavorable ratings were 2/3 and his favorable was 1/3. So we celebrate him now, but when people are causing trouble, they're not popular. And so my dad's point was that when you're facing a system that seems so profound and so enormous and so all-encompassing, for him, slavery and Jim Crow were the examples I would add now mass incarceration to that list. When you're facing something like that, you're going to feel lonely. You're going to feel unpopular. And it's going to seem impossible. And so when my dad kind of was wrapping it up, he said, so here's the thing. People, when you're facing that, will tell you that change is impossible. But then if you ignore them and you fight and you protest and you litigate and you legislate, right, if you ignore them and you then create the change, those same people will turn around and be like, oh yeah, that was inevitable. I knew you were going to win. And then they're going to say they were there. I mean, my dad was like, look, the March on Washington had 250,000 people, which is a big number. But if you ask now, it's like 10 million people will say they were there. And so to me, that's really the lesson, right, about being an activist and an advocate for social change. And so I don't know, right, I don't know that who's the person in the room or the group of people in the room or what's the idea that's going to come out of this room. That's going to be the new strategy, the new tactic, the new organization. Right? SNCC was started on a university campus. That's going to change the course to bend towards a more just criminal system, a criminal system that's actually worthy of the title criminal justice system. But I know you're out. I know you're there, and you're going to come up with an idea that's unknown even to me now. And when you do, and you win, they're going to make a movie about you. And I'll be there in the front row with my popcorn. Thank you.
Thank you. What's coming up next for you?
I have a long list of things that I'm thinking about as my next writing project. The commitment that I made to my wife after the kind of grueling process of producing this book and the 7 days of, you know, week work weeks was to take a year and to work on op-eds and essays and things like that, that where I could feel like I was sort of doing my writing but not necessarily undertaking a project as big as a book. Actually, the thing that I've been thinking about working on is a project that was more organized around really the kind of the last half of my talk. Not those ideas necessarily per se, but something that's focused on more on the solutions piece of this, the kind of what to do about this.
Is there a cost-benefit analysis of our current punitive justice system?
If you want to talk about a program that has never been like cost-justified, it would be mass incarceration. It would be our prison system. Because every time any analysis has been done, the analysis finds that an alternative will save society typically anywhere between $2-$5 for every dollar spent. So for example, education. We, in 1994, as part of the war on crime rhetoric and that terrible crime, 1994 crime legislation, when Bill Clinton was president, that bill, one of the things that it did was it ended Pell Grants for people who are incarcerated. So today, we have about a 90% reduction in prison education programs from what we had in the 1970s and 1980s. And it's not like we had enough in the 70s and 80s. And the RAND Corporation, is not the only analysis, but it's a very well-regarded kind of center sort of organization in a lot of respects. And they've analyzed that for every dollar that we spend on the education of prisoners, society recoups $5 in benefit. And the main benefit that you get is the increased taxes that people pay because they become employed when they get out, and also a somewhat of a reduction on reduced court costs because of reduced recidivism. Those are the two big, you know, pay more taxes, collect fewer public benefits, and lower recidivism. So you can really go down the line on almost any issue that you might want to pick and find, you know, an economic analysis that would support the alternative to incarceration. I mean, it's just so there's little that we do that's more expensive than, you know, locking people up. In D.C., for example, which has relatively robust education spending compared to some other districts, but in D.C., when I looked at the numbers about 10 years ago, it was about $18,000 a year per child in the K-12 system and about $140,000 a year per child in the juvenile justice system. In California, the ratio is 20 to 1. So it's a very, very expensive proposition. And so I think actually that the fact that this is so expensive, right, is one of the things that's brought more and more people to the table in terms of, and in some of the jurisdictions where there's been reform of the criminal system, because that's the other thing, there's been a lot of legislation has passed even in the last year. Like everybody says, well, you know, criminal justice reform is dead, but at those state level, that has not been true at all. Louisiana, which has the highest incarceration rates in the country, right, just think about that. The state that has the highest incarceration rates in the country, that has the highest incarceration rates in the world, passed a major, very broad-based and significant criminal justice reform package that involved turning a lot of felonies into misdemeanors. It involved a lot of diversion programs. It involved making parole. And a lot of the Republicans that voted for it did it because of the cost analysis. Now, I'm wary of going too far down the cost analysis, because one of the things that happens sometimes is that I want the money that gets saved by reduced expenditures in the criminal system to go, I want to make sure that money gets funneled into communities, right, that right now, that need it, right? I talked about how people for 50 years had this all of the above strategy, more money for jobs and schools and housing, and all they got was more money for police. So I want to make sure that we divert some of that money and that it doesn't just get kind of lost. But yeah, I think the economic case is there to be made.
Is racism the primary reason why the government has money for jails and not for social welfare and drug rehab programs?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. That's super important. And that is a huge part, right, of the answer, racism. And it would be the dominant part of the explanation. I don't think it's the only explanation. I think probably the second most important explanation is that this country more broadly is incredibly punitive and is much more likely or sort of more quickly turns to kind of law enforcement, punishment-oriented solutions. Now, some of that, then it does to investments in social welfare and other things. And some of that, of course, that punitiveness is not unrelated to racism, where we started. And in some ways, the racism that produces punitiveness, that punitiveness sort of extends out and beyond the original group that it was intended. Some states whose prison population is majority white have incredibly brutal and unrehabilitative-oriented prisons. And we know, for example, just look at this last debate about the Affordable Care Act that's happening at a moment when we have this opioid crisis in America. President Trump runs on the claim that he's going to deal with the heroin problem and the opioid problem, and many Republican congressmen say similar things. And then they get into office and they vote to cut funding for drug treatment programs, including drug treatment programs that are in some cases disproportionately and in some cases overwhelmingly targeted towards working class white folks, right? So class is a piece of this as well. I mean, Dr. King, really smart, right? And really clear about this, right? He has all of those, you know, he has that famous, you know, exchange with his jailers where there, you know, he starts talking about the civil rights case and black freedom and equality, and they start talking back to him about all the errors in his thinking. And he says, well, let me ask you this. How much money do y'all make? These are white jailers. And they give him the answer. And he's like, y'all need to be marching with us. Right? They couldn't even see the ways in which they were being exploited because of the way the racism had blinded them to that. Right? So, and he talked about that all the time. So I do think that we have to kind of hold two ideas in our head at the same time, right? One is that we have this deeply embedded racism that, in my opinion, starts with and is grounded in slavery, that if you look at most of the racial stereotypes that we have in this society today, right, most of them are come out of the rationalizations that a country has to create for itself and that individual people have to create for themselves to justify a system as brutal as chattel slavery, right? And it's very particular. Particular stereotypes. Black people, you have to justify why it is that you won't let people learn how to read and study. And the justification that you create for yourself is, they don't care about education anyway. Right? They can't learn and they don't want to learn. Those are stereotypes that grow directly out of slavery. Black people and their children. Right? So much of the injustice and the unfairness in our child welfare system grows out of this stereotype that, well, black people don't care about their kids. That's why it's okay to take them away. Well, where's that come from? A society needs to create that lie for itself to justify that one of the basic ingredients of slavery, which was ripping apart black families, literally taking black children from their parents at auction block. Well, how do you justify? Because we have a human desire to justify our actions. Well, how do you justify that? Oh, they don't care about their kids anyway. Right? Black criminality. You can go down the line for any stereotype. So that is a part of the story. And then there's also this class story that we have to hold alongside that. We are really relatively unforgiving as a society and ungenerous as a society towards poor people across the board. And that has all kinds of terrible implications for criminal justice debates. You see this all the time. Like people say, I talked about education, right? At college for prisoners. People say, well, why are you paying for their education? Right? I can't even get a free education. Well, yeah, that's a problem too, right? But because we've done that, we then create this. So I think that all of that said, I think that what we have in American history, and we have always had, is we've always had this racism, and we've always had this classism, and we've always had this elitism, we've always had this punitiveness, and at the same time, we've had profound social justice movements that at particular moments, right, have overcome aspects of that, have created common bonds of humanity, have caused people to think outside of their own narrow self-interest, have caused people to put their lives and their bodies on the line, right, people of all races, to fight for justice. And so, to me, I can hold those beliefs in my head at the same time, that this stuff is permanent and it's entrenched, and that we can overcome it.
That was James Forman Jr. on Crime and Punishment in Black America. He spoke in Chicago. James Forman Jr. is a professor of law at Yale Law School and is the author of Locking Up Our Own. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. we feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Richard Wolff, Michelle Alexander, David K. Johnston, Nancy McLean, Glenn Greenwald, Brian Stevenson, Angela Davis, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, James Forman Jr. on Crime and Punishment in Black America, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Jacqueline Seberg and Susan Jaden. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with the great tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins performing Duke Ellington's In a Sentimental Mood.